is day four, side A. So you were talking about your typical day, and we'd gotten up more or less to, I got mid-afternoon.
Yeah, and then actually at around, you know, somewhere between between 4 and 5, I go running.
Right.
Right, depending on, you know, how the, where we are in the year and so on and so forth, typically early in the winter and later in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So today they're going early for some reason, but and then, you know, I pack up basically and go home. And we pick up the kids actually,
right,
who go to a daycare center.
And
right
on. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right on campus here.
Oh, okay.
I'm on the oversight committee, so I'm quite active on dealing with daycare issues here.
You're plugged into the community here.
I mean, I'm sorry?
You're plugged into the community here in many ways, yeah.
Right.
Now the, what was I going to ask? It's just slipped my mind. Oh, how far do you live from here?
Oh, just a couple of miles, 4 miles.
Okay. So
if I didn't have to pick up the kids, it would be easy biking distance.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what is the routine once you get home? Who tends to prepare the food? Who tends to help the children?
Yeah, so that Sarah does most. Well, no, the children, you know, we share that in equal measure. But she definitely, you know, I'd cook maybe once a week versus she'd prepare food 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And But, you know, I'd put the kids to bed about, you know, half the time or something like that. So, and
do you tend to, I mean, do you take some work home then? Do you work on it before you go to bed? Or do you
So I try. You know, it really depends. Invariably, I take home a stack of stuff about 2 inches thick. And, you know, rarely do I make it through a tenth of that, and sometimes I don't do anything simply because I'm very tired, and you know, by the time, you know, 10 o'clock rolls around, it's time to, you know, read some non-science stuff and pack it in. So,
right,
you know, I need sort of 6-7 hours of sleep. That's pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
More like 7, I think. Over longer time period. So,
if you would assess your efforts so far in achieving your professional goals, I mean, are you more or less where you want to be professionally, or is there more to do?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I'm certainly not dissatisfied. You know, there are, you know, science is, you know, the horizon is always very far away, and there are always lots of things to do scientifically. We've achieved certain things that intellectually that we've tried to achieve, so that's been sort of even long-term goals. So we're, you know, I'm fairly content with what we've gotten done, but you know, it's never-ending story, and it's very exciting, you know, and I really rarely look back, frankly. And professionally, if you say about scientific, about recognition from the community, and I'm certainly, I don't have any reasons to complain. I think I get what I deserve, and not too much more.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so it's, you know, I have options with respect to where to go, you know, from very, very good places. And as I mentioned, I'm just sort of thinking about moving, and that's, I mean, I think that's quite nice to have options.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the most important thing to me, and to have essentially to options to work where you want to work and to live where you want to work.
Right.
To live where you want to live.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of also, I think, the most important part of recognition, is to be, you know, be
desired in
right.
that sense. Yeah.
To be sought after.
Yeah, sought after, right.
Mm-hmm. And you're in the middle of that process now, deciding whether you're going
right.
to move, right?
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Let's turn to sort of the last part of the question set, which is more or less about public policy questions, and then sort of a grab bag. I call them just big philosophical
mm-hmm.
questions
mm-hmm.
About sort of ideas, where your ideas come from, inevitability of science, things of that sort. But let's start with maybe patents. Do you have any patents?
I've applied for a couple of patents. One of them is fairly long, far along, and another one which I'm much more, sort of really excited about is actually this thing I mentioned to you earlier about silencing neurons in an inducible manner. That we have just sort of we had a provisional application.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you don't have any patents now, but you have some
right.
underway.
Right.
Yeah. What do you believe? Are patents generally good for science? Do you believe?
It's probably not, actually. No, are patents good for science? I think the answer is probably not, because very few of us do science for patents. We would be doing science anyways, and of
right.
course patents can have a devastating effect on doing science in some instances. Now, that doesn't mean that patents aren't absolutely necessary for drug development and so on, right? Because if you develop a drug, you need protection, because if you have the drug, you need to profit from it. And but you ask specifically whether or not... my patenting, some of the things that we do in the lab, and we haven't done it much, we could have done it much more, is really, mercenary.
Right.
It's something you can do, something you can... It doesn't cost me anything, and it may, in fact, yield financial benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't have done anything differently without being able to apply for patents.
Right. A question about ideas. Where do your ideas come from?
That's a good question, right? Where do ideas come from? I think we're fairly, we have lots of ideas, and where do they come from? Ideas for projects usually come from data, so you look at data and you see things that one you don't understand, and the idea to pursue a certain experiment is to really understand some data that you've collected. But I think the more fundamental question of what kind of research direction to pursue, which is not really an idea, it's sort of defining what an important open problem is, comes from, of course, reading and talking to people and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And, but once you have an area and a research program, I find that ideas for particular experiments and particular directions really immediately follow from previous experiments. It's one of these things where you do one experiment and you maybe address one experiment, but you end up with 10 other experiments. It's really bewildering multiplication, and choosing the most important experiment is actually another skill I think that's quite important.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if we've done that actually always as effectively as we should have.
Right.
It's also a matter of taste, actually, to some extent.
Right, yeah. How important is creativity, let's say, to the doing of good science? Like when you're doing a study section and you pick up a grant, I mean, are there instances where you can say, you know, here, clearly, creativity is coming out at the seams? If so, I guess, how important is it? And then, what is it?
Yeah. Well, I think it's, I really think it's really undervalued in science, okay, sort of. And what I see sort of creativity together with innovation, right? Essentially doing something, putting things together that hadn't been put together. And it is very rare that one reads, you know, I mean, the longer you've been in this business, the rarer it is that one reads something where one is really surprised by the approach, where one is really... You know, recently I read a grant where that was the case. You know, it was just incredibly pleasurable, and usually that's such a drag reading these grants, simply because many of them aren't very good and are really derivative. And then one reads the grant where, you know, where it's not clear where this thing is going because it's so innovative and so different, and but it's clearly incredibly rich, and it's just, I think it's the absolutely the best thing in you know, that it's the most important thing, I think, in science, and also relatively undervalued. And yeah, I mean, I think it's very important.
Can creativity be cultivated? Can you learn it?
That's a good question. I think it can be. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Perhaps by example, because creativity doesn't necessarily mean that you have to invent something. It doesn't mean that you have to calculate something that no one else can calculate, but it often means being on your toes and putting together things that haven't been put together, and sort of drawing from... you can be creative through scholarship, right? If you sort of make connections, if you know more, and if you know more in some depth, where you... you know, it's often... If you become more fluent in more techniques and more sort of concepts. So many of, I think, my most, you know, what I would call most creative ideas are putting together things that other people haven't put together, because I have worked in many different fields,
right.
You know, in single molecule biophysics. And so I've sort of, you know, applied single molecule sort of concepts to synapses, which... You know, in hindsight, maybe it's not that it was relatively natural to me, I think, but to many other people, it might have looked very creative, because they would have never thought of it, and it's sort of, you know, in the eye of the beholders to some extent.
Right.
But I think being versed in many different, you know, we're doing also sort of software design. It allows us to do complex experiments in creative experiments that are just an order of magnitude more complex than what most people do with canned software, you know, complicated sequences of stimuli and automation and all these kinds of things. And and I think in general, putting together techniques and insights from different fields, and putting together chemistry, genetics, and neurobiology and physiology. I think there are lots of sort of interesting things that come together, and I think that is sort of one form of creativity, is putting these sort of different things together.
A question about serendipity. We talked about creativity, sort of the deliberate search for new ways of doing things. Serendipity, where it sort of falls in your lap. What role has serendipity played in your research, if at all?
Well, I think it has played played some role in my research, especially early on. So the first project I ever did in grad school, which was, well, not the first, but the first project, well, I mean, I guess it was really the second project, but a project on kinesin, which was sort of the core of my thesis. In hindsight, we made a couple of very significant choices that were completely lucky, essentially. So first of all, we chose to work on kinesin, which is a molecular motor that turns out to be very well behaved in biochemically and in these single molecule assays. Mm-hmm. Myosin and dynein turn out to be much more difficult, and that can be the difference between doing and not doing the experiment, right? You can be hung up because of uncontrolled problems for years and not get anything done. To this day, no one has really figured out how to really work with dynein in these single molecule experiments. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, 12 years later. So that's really serendipitous. And I probably, you know, if Steve would have said, you know, let's work on dynein, I would say, all right, let's work on dynein. And of course, he didn't have any more information, right? Except that we knew how to get kinesin and there was local expertise around and so on. Then the other thing was there we really couldn't, the information wasn't around. But then we made a right choice in using optical trapping. That's of course something that Steve had already set up in his lab, so it was natural, but if we had used mechanical fibers, little microneedles, which other people had tried to use, that would have been a serious mistake. And there we could have done the calculation, the analysis beforehand, but I only did that in, you know, chapter 4 of my thesis after I'd done the measurement, you know, and realized why it was really a dumb idea to use, because of something called the fluctuation dissipation theorem and the way noise is spectrally distributed for large probes that have large viscous drag versus small probes like a bead in an optical trap that have low viscous drag. And it just turns out to be much more favorable for signal-to-noise ratios to use these small probes. So there, we were dumb and lucky, you know. So...
A question about scientific progress. And this is a horrifying prospect, but I don't want to entertain it too long, but if your lab were suddenly, let's say, had disappeared and then last year,
yeah,
would the work that you've done in the lab over the last year, would that have been done anyway, I guess, by another lab at another time, do you feel?
Yeah, I ask myself that often. I really don't think so. I mean, in general, we've done, you know, pretty unusual things. And now you could maybe criticize that we did some things that not that many people care about, okay? But but we've done some things that a lot of people care about, right? But I think... I think that and there are a couple of little fields that have come out of the kinds of things that we're doing in the lab. So I think the probably is not the case. It's not like cloning the, cloning some G protein and being the first, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and doing structure of some kinase and being the first. I think here, there's a lot of stuff to do in neuroscience. I think the important issue is to really be doing important stuff and to also do stuff that people are still interested in 10 years from now, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of survives in terms of still being interesting and central to neuroscience and also, of course, being right.
Right.
So 10 years later, which...
is also important.
Yeah. That's actually the thing that the one thing that keeps me up at night is that, you know, making sure that what we're publishing is correct. Mm-hmm.
A question about the literature in your field. and really more about the history of science. Is it important, do you feel, or is it useful for sort of the average workaday scientist to know the history of his or her field? Is that necessary to do good science, or is that helpful to do good science?
Yeah, I'm not sure how important it is. I mean, I think it's helpful to it can be inspiring, right? So for one thing, you know, and also it can be humbling, and I think that's also an important thing. And lastly, I think if you look at, I mean, the history of science, of course, only remembers, very few of us will be remembered by the canon of history, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe through the Pew work, that will be a little broader, but probably if you look at all of the people that you do interviews with, right? I mean, how many of them will really be remembered 100 years from now, right? I mean, very few. And so what one can look at, what's been very useful for me is to look at kinds of people who did very significant things and ask, you know, how did they go about that and what made them successful? What kind of risks did they take? How did they choose their problems and their preparations and their collaborators and so on? And of course, things are different now than they were in the 40s and 50s, you know, like Hodgkin and Huxley, who are some of my heroes. But nevertheless, I think one can learn from them. And of course, it's not so clear. We know exactly how things were done back then and what went through their heads, except through autobiographical accounts. And who knows how, to what extent these are in fact accurate. You know, so.
Right.
But if you're thinking more, you're thinking probably more about sort of the history of scientific thought.
That too. I was just wondering.
Yeah. So there's very little actually written. I find very little written about that in neuroscience. You know, it's really a relatively young field, and you know, there's some pretty crazy ideas around still pretty recently, so I'm not sure how useful it is.
Well, when you were in graduate school and doing your postdoc, did you find people who stressed the history of a particular field as sort of a prologue to any particular experiment or something? Mm. And by that, I mean, I realize that it can be like 2 years, 3 years, that's fairly normal, but let's say 5-10 years, you know, really try to do sort of the historical...
Right. No, on that time scale, of course. Yeah. I thought you were thinking 100 years now.
And well, that's fine, too.
Yeah. Well, that's very different, because in many of the... So molecular motors, right, that field was really 10 papers, right? So we knew every paper, and we knew who all the players were and where they came from, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this guy did hair cell mechanotransduction. It was sort of, he was interested in adaptation, and that's how he got to work on molecular motors. This person worked on kinases and you know, ATPases, and that's how, you know. And so the strength, it was pretty clear where their approaches came from, where their viewpoints came from, and that you know, that was sort of a 5-year time scale, and we knew all of those things and knew where they came from and probably knew roughly where they were going. But then these fields were relatively, there was no longer history.
Right.
Then there was, of course, the history of muscle research, right, which is a whole bunch of molecular motors. And that also you got exposed to, because, again, some of the key players came from muscle research, and they dominated the field intellectually in some sense or another, because they had models of how motors might work.
Right.
And so you had to learn the history over time, because, you know, some of those papers were written in the 50s and 60s.
Right. So it really depended on the field then?
Yeah, it really depends on the field, right.
Okay.
And Yeah, and in neuroscience, it's actually quite useful. It is quite useful now that I think about it, because many of the sort of neuroanatomy, for example, is an old field using essentially the same methods for about 100 years. And I think some of the, in my opinion, neuroanatomy is a terrible backwater. It's really inexcusable, because I think it's very, very important to understand the structure of the biological substrate to understand its function, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the same with, you know, I think that you have DNA, right? And the structure made biological meaning apparent. It's not always quite as miraculous as that, but it's always very informative. And the study of neuroanatomy of the brain is really very primitive, and most of the tools are 100 years old, and it's not clear why that is, actually, but it's sort of entrenched in methodologically and not very quantitative.
Right.
And it was a very powerful tradition that hasn't really evolved. So if understanding how that came about is, I think, quite interesting.
Can you be a cutting-edge scientist, though, and pretty much bypass the history altogether? More or less, depending again on how old or new the field is.
Can you be a good scientist and bypass the history?
Yeah,
I'm not sure how you can be a good scientist and ignore the literature, right? And the literature, in some sense, is the history, unless you have some kind of written history that supersedes that.
Right. And how large that literature is, has a course on the newness,
right,
and the oldness of the field.
Exactly,
right.
And then that's right, and then of course you only read the tiny, tiny fraction of that, right? The stuff that survives, that is sort of cited over generations,
mm-hmm,
and collected in reprint volumes and so on and so forth. But I think it is fairly important to understand what came before, and you know, to understand the ideas and how they came about.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you take a history of science class at any point in your... No. Were they offered, do you know?
Let's see. Good question. I mean, I'm sure they were offered at Harvard, right?
Right.
I mean, they have the history of science programs, and there were famous history of science professors. And... No, my sort of education on that front, beyond reading the literature in my field, is really from, you know, autobiographical accounts and
right,
stuff like that. And,
I want to ask a question about technology. I mean, it's fairly obvious to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but technology plays an immense role in what you do and your research.
Right.
And how fast it moves forward. So I won't ask that, but what I will ask is, in what way maybe has your science specifically been promoted by, that's not quite what I want to say. I guess what I'm trying to say is, does the fact that technology is so important in your science, does that change the way you think about your science? Has that changed? Can you see changes in your own thinking, let's say, over the last 5, 6, 7 years, because, again, of the technological capabilities now that you have? Does that actually affect the way that you think about science?
Well, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Design?
No. I mean, that actually, I mean, if you look at the history of neuroscience, right? So you're just coming from that. It's intimately tied, the whole intellectual development is intimately tied to technological innovation, because it's not surprising that is so, I think, because the brain is very, very complicated, right? I mean, that's one thing everyone agrees on, right? And that the tools that we have to study the brain are really limiting, fundamentally. I'm talking now about experimental tools, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have in your brain, million times a million neurons, and you know, connected by a million times a billion synapses. And the way people study neurons in an awake monkey is by sticking one wire into neurons, recording from one neuron. It's just very, very primitive with the complexity, compared to the complexity of the system. And the and if you look at the history of neuroscience, each time you have some kind of methodological breakthrough, it's immediately coupled to real insight, right? And sort of Hodgkin and Huxley really made use of that. In you know, they really benefited from the invention of the voltage clamp amplifier, which allowed them to figure out how the action potential worked. And lots of really good experiments, the same is true for anatomy, right? It's sort of the Golgi method that allowed Cahal to sort out the basics of cortical connectivity, and that, that cells, in fact, the neurons are in fact cells, and so on. There are several examples of that, I think, and so I think in a, on a sort of more modest scale, that happens with us. You know, we we can do things now that we couldn't just a couple of years ago that have completely changed the way we think about single synapses. Okay, mm-hmm. And that also allow then a secondary analysis that we couldn't have done a couple of years ago. I mean, there are examples like that are many, and sort of on a day-to-day level, but also, you know, technology, neuroscience just moves entire fields.
Right.
And right, I mean, DNA arrays is another example. PCR. I mean, there's so many of these that, mm-hmm. that we could. Yeah.
Are there drawbacks to technology?
Are there drawbacks to technology? I mean, you mean for the doing of science, or the fact that of a mutually assured destruction? Which one?
Well,
what is a drawback?
That is a drawback. Yeah, I guess.
But that's not our fault.
That's right. Yeah. Science is neutral, but. I guess some people have made the case that technology is getting more and more expensive, that sometimes the people who have, you know, the biggest, most the shiniest machines are now industry labs as well. Mm. And there are sometimes restrictions on that kind of research. There are pros and cons to that as well. But I guess the point they're making is that as technology becomes perhaps more expensive, then there's a divide between the labs that can afford such hardware and those that can't, and that there might be this growing division in science. Is that a perceived fear, real fear, or just...
Yeah, I don't think that makes a lot of sense. I think technology always comes with, of course, new machines, but typically, you know, these things... I mean, if you think about it, right, I mean, let's take an example. It makes typically... the same bit of scientific insight, you know, you can think of it as a little bit or literally bit, you know, mm-hmm. piece of information, now is much more easily gained, right? If you can think of, you know, DNA array as 20,000 northerns, right? And northern is a very wasteful thing if you can do it with a cDNA array.
Mm.
Right, and of course, so there was a time when very few labs could do cDNA arrays, and they deserved to be at the forefront because they developed the technology. Now, everyone can make their own, they just have to get off their ass and do it, get together, buy the robots, buy the oligos, or whatever kind of arrays. And then there are, of course, commercial outfits that charge you an arm and a leg, and they do it slightly better, and some labs are wealthier and will be able to benefit from that more. Mm-hmm. But it's really always has been like that, I think. And it's not, I think, a function of technological advancement. And I mean, it's really more related to the topic that we discussed earlier, that mm-hmm. there are you know, there are poor labs and there are rich labs, and some labs deserve to be poor and some labs don't deserve to be rich, you know.
Right. Right, right. It does get back to that.
Yeah.
My question about tenure. Do you have tenure? Oh, we already talked about tenure.
Yeah.
You don't have tenure here.
Yeah.
Okay. We often hear that there's a biomedical revolution underway, biomedical. Do you believe, in your own opinion, that we're going through this revolution?
No, I think that's total bullshit.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why?
In my opinion, because it's a thing. Well, we're going through, I think, a time of considerable discovery in biomedical research, but I can't see that it's any faster than, over the last, 20, 30 years. I mean, clearly, molecular biology started with genes, right, with DNA. It really didn't exist before the 60s. But it would be ludicrous to say that we're actually progressing faster than in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you know, when people worked out all of the basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more people doing it now, but then I find, personally, okay, I find there's a huge disconnect between, I should be careful here, but between, you know, the claims and the reality, right? I mean, if you really look at the number of drugs that have come out of biological discovery, basic biological discovery, so now the medical part, and rational understanding of mechanism, these drugs are negligible.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I mean, there are very few of them, and that's directly reflected in the fact that biotech has been a horrible investment, right, since its existence. I mean, as a matter of fact, venture capital has poured, $120 billion into biotech, and the whole biotech market, I think, is valued at $80 billion. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's been a black hole for venture capital. You know, it really hasn't lived up to its promise, and I'm not sure it does. It will anytime soon, because I mean, we're learning a lot about basic mechanism, but putting that into the context of the system, you know, people and is complexity that is, and you can't do high throughput screening on mice or people, right? And so it's terra incognita. Many drugs that are approved by the FDA for something were actually quote-unquote designed for something else. They just happen to have some beneficial side effects, right? I mean, the NMDA receptor blockers are now beginning to be used for pain, where they were sort of developed for epilepsy, you know, 20 years later.
Right.
So there is progress, but it's really often disconnected from basic biomedical research. And often connected, but I don't see the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, you know, it's sort of semi-blindly stumbling forward, and that's as good as we can do.
Right.
And what worries me about this is especially neuroscience, because neuroscience, you know, the development of drugs in neuroscience has been especially disappointing, I think. Is that, you know, all these claims about, you know, the decade of the brain, what good has it done to treat this, to treat that, and then, you know, we won't be able to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, the public has to, you know, stand up and say, well, you've been promising this for all these years, and what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
It's really lobbying at, you know, at its best and at its worst, and I think.
Right. Some people, when they make this claim, also point to the Human Genome Project, and they'll say, well, here we have for the first time, you know, we have the plan, as it were, and we also have sort of new technology like microarrays, where we can, instead of dealing with one particular gene, we can deal with massive amounts of genes and see how they interact.
But you know what happened to these companies that were based on genome data, right? I mean, the market knows all this stuff. They don't fall for this bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, those companies don't exist anymore.
Right.
Right. And it's companies that make making a drug is the hard thing. And the Human Genome Project, there are plenty of targets, right? The Human Genome Project will allow you to find targets, and but there we know lots of targets, but people don't have drugs.
Right.
It's there is no easy way to make drugs that work.
Right.
Nothing has advanced there, I think. You know, I mean, high throughput screening is great, but that's sort of the first step. Everyone knows that, mm-hmm. and there are lots and lots. You know, these Merck, Pfizer, they've got lots of interesting stuff in their fridge that I'd like to get my hands on for the laboratory work. That blockers of this and blockers of that, but that, you know, tiny fraction ever make it out of the first clinical trials.
Right. Yeah. Is competition generally good for the creation of good science?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it is, really. Yeah, I think in bounds, you know, I think that it's difficult to regulate competition.
Right.
But, you know, I think it does keep you on your toes. It really does focus the mind. It sort of reduces waste. I think it's a necessary evil. You know.
The other side to competition is collaborations. How important is collaboration in your science?
Yeah, right now? It's fairly important. I'd like it to be more important. And so we've had a few collaborations that I'm quite happy with that have given us a lot, and where we've, I think, contributed a lot to other people's science. But I really think that the kinds of problems that we're dealing with, cortex, for example, right, the mammalian cortex. So the part of the 10-year plan that I've described to you, right, that is not a single laboratory project. Right, it there are too many facets to it that and also not just the intellectual resources but the financial resources of my laboratory are not large enough to do a good job of, you know, having transgenic mice that express, for example, activity dependent reporters in all interesting cell classes in the cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be ridiculous to make these mice only for myself if that's what we actually did. Ideally, I'd like to work with someone who is good at finding specific cell promoters. I work with someone who is good in developing probes, then use our expertise in sort of imaging technology and data mining for imaging data and apply them to, you know, to interesting experiments in the Barrett cortex, but at the same time have this sort of consortium work with other people who study other problems in the cortex in a different brain area. And I think that would be the right way to do it. And I think the challenge is to get people involved who and to establish it in a way that everyone gets credit for the piece mm-hmm. that they do, and you know, and that still doesn't work quite right in biology, especially, you know, mm-hmm. it's sort of not clear how these really collaborative projects will work when tenure comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
In some cases, have you found that collaborations are actually frowned upon when tenure discussions arise?
Yeah, I think there are So it's right. If they're collaborations and you're the top dog, then it's sort of not frowned upon. But if you somehow yell less loud and turn out not to be the top dog in the author list, then you. So it there are people who are very collaborative, who are also very generous, who sometimes get the short end of the stick. On the other hand, that happens relatively rarely, and I think, you know, good colleagues in the right places are rewarded for being good colleagues.
Right.
So, I mean, in a wise place, that would be the case. I mean, you have to pull your weight, you know, you have to be recognized, you have to publish enough to get grants, and, you know, and so on and so forth. I think that's very important. But, you know, if everyone knows that you're a very good colleague, very generous, and that you don't care whether or not you're last or next to last author, you know, that won't really perturb your tenure decision. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you know, there are these collaborations of necessity that you know, where you have these people who control. Now, here is a place where resources are really, I think, a different matter. So there are laboratories that have a lot of resources to make mice. And we're now turning into one of these labs, and we have at least the resources, but that is a very valuable resource if you have interesting genetically modified mouse. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, there are some people who just want to be on every paper that's done with that mouse, and I think that's not really a collaboration, but it's sort of an aberration, and you know, should be frowned upon. But
right. It happens, right?
It's routine, actually.
Really?
It's often happens, yeah.